What a very good evening, everybody. Welcome to our seminar hosted by the LSE Southeast Asia Centre. My name's Nick Long. I'm an assistant professor in the anthropology department here. And it's my pleasure to introduce for us this evening a long-standing friend and associate of the Southeast Asia Centre, Stephen James. So Stephen has had a lifelong interest in Vietnam. And I think one of the things that's going to be incredibly exciting about tonight's presentation is the fact that his relationship with Vietnam really is very multifaceted. He actually grew up in Vietnam for the first 14 years of his life, from 1962 to 1975, when he was evacuated. And after that, he's had a very varied and exciting career teaching in the Philippines at the University of Mindanao, working with the Ministry of Education in Turkmenistan, but being drawn back to thinking about the lives of the Vietnamese. He worked in refugee camps, and now he's been doing anthropological fieldwork with Vietnamese diaspora, and it's that material that he's going to be sharing with us today. It's part of the fieldwork he's been doing as he's completing his PhD in anthropology at the University of California, Riverside, where he's also a lecturer in global studies. So it really is a great opportunity to hear some thoughts on the contemporary Vietnamese experience from someone who has engaged with Vietnamese populations in so many different ways and who is also thinking in so many different academic disciplines and from so many different perspectives. So, Stephen, thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, all of you. Thank you to the Southeast Asian Center. Thank you to all of you for being here. This is and LSE as a whole. I come in the process of doing my research. I'm at the tail end of a number of years of research, almost a decade, a little over a decade now, working with Vietnamese in London. And so that's, you're getting sort of the first blush of my research as I'm beginning to pull together data and pull together interviews and perspectives from my interlocutors. So what I'd like to do tonight, if it's all right with you, is to we'll have about 35 or 40 minutes, and I'd like to go through some slides, giving you some idea, thumbnail sketch of my research in terms of its methodology, in terms of the research question that I'm asking, looking at a little bit of the literature, not wanting it to get too academic, but at the same time wanting to ground it in the literature. And then what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is to have some interaction. And so we will have questions at the end, but I might be breaking you up into your neighbors and having you ask a question here and there along the way, just to keep us awake as we go through the evening. Again, thank you so much for allowing me to be here. So as we begin to look at this whole idea of Vietnamese trajectories, how Vietnamese have moved from one place to another in time and through space, what I'm focused on in particular is this whole idea of forced migration. And so that's what we'll be looking at, in particular with Vietnamese, the double forced migration of Chinese background Vietnamese who came out of Vietnam, not because of the Vietnam War, as many people think, but a boat population, the boat people, as many call them, but a boat migration that came as a result of other sort of intra-socialist conflicts that had nothing to do with the Cold War. And so we'll be talking a little bit about that. So let's begin, first of all, with the research question. And what I'm focusing on here, I won't be reading all of these. I'll let you do that. But I'd like to just unpack a few things with each of the slides. The whole idea is to focus, I'm focused on the process of refugee settlement over time. And I'm looking particularly at how this double forced migration has allowed Vietnamese to engage with identity and establish belonging in communities with respect to really two multi-ethnic centers, Hong Kong and London, a very unlikely connection. As we move into the context, I'm focused specifically on these the forced migration experiences of what in Vietnamese is called the Viet Goc Hoa, the Chinese background Vietnamese. This word Goc is a word that means root, and so often this slang or the short term is Goc Hoa. And so this is the Chinese background Vietnamese boat migrants who left Vietnam, really some of them in the mid to late 70s all the way through 1995 and just prior to the handover of Hong Kong to China from Britain, the colony. So after some period of time in refugee camps in Hong Kong, and the refugee camp experience was quite problematic in that in the beginning there was a welcome of the Vietnamese refugees to some extent in Hong Kong. But when the numbers began to climb, the camps that they were settled in, the reception camps, were turned into incarceration camps, really, and closed. And so the latter Vietnamese, the latter population who came in, were incarcerated for some of them up to 3 or 4 years. And one gentleman was telling me that he met a four-year-old who had never set his feet on grass. They were in a concrete incarceration camp for 4 years. So the idea is to then look at the process of the out-migration from Hong Kong into the United Kingdom and eventually to London. So this is sort of the context which we'll be looking. These global moves took place as a result of these two key post-Vietnam War historical events. The first is the Sino-Vietnamese War, the border wars of 1979-82. Just to unpack that a little bit, how did that happen? How did China and Vietnam come to blows in 1979? It really began in late 1978 when Vietnam began massing troops on the border with Cambodia. And my interviewees are telling me that essentially what was happening was a fear on the part of the Vietnamese government. Pol Pot was in power in Cambodia, if you remember at that time, Kampuchea. And Pol Pot was threatening the border with Vietnam. Vietnam was concerned about that and invaded Kampuchea in 1979. That invasion sparked the Chinese, who were supporting Pol Pot, the Soviet Union obviously supporting the Vietnamese. The Chinese warned Vietnam not to invade. They invaded anyway, and China then invaded on the northern border of Vietnam. And so Vietnam was then fighting on two fronts. The problem with the Chinese background Vietnamese in Vietnam, this third sort of piece, this third leg of the stool, was the fact that the Vietnamese government was concerned that the Chinese in Vietnam, a very influential, very wealthy population, would rise up from within. And so then they would have three fronts on which to fight. And so that's the history behind this Sino-Vietnamese border war, a very complex history that I think many of us have been unaware of. So that was the first sort of instigation. There wasn't a policy of extermination, as there has been in other countries, of ethnic cleansing. There wasn't a national policy at all in terms of the exit of Chinese background Vietnamese. From my interviewees, they're saying it was more of a suggestion, in a sense, a local decision on the part of many of the provinces, many of the towns and villages to move the Vietnamese, the Chinese background Vietnamese, out. Often they had the wealth of the community in their hands. And so this is the context from the Sino-Vietnamese border wars in terms of Hong Kong colony. As you know, in 1997, the end of the 99-year lease came and Britain handed Hong Kong back over to China. And China's statement to Margaret Thatcher at that time, Prime Minister of Britain, was, "We will not inherit the Vietnamese problem," as they called it. And so this is the context in which Britain had to somehow move these people on, and we'll look a little bit at that a little bit more in a moment. So that means that Chinese background Vietnamese have been now in London for up to 40 years. I'm situating my research in really three areas: mobility and migration studies. Then I'm looking at identity and subjectivity, looking at this whole idea of who am I, and then space and context, looking at Hong Kong and London. In terms of the literature, to give some sort of background, what I'm looking at is double force migrations and displacements. They may call into question essential and binary notions of nationality, belonging, identity. We often think of the Vietnamese, and there is no understanding of the Vietnamese. There are many Vietnamese communities, many ways of looking at the Vietnamese, many ways that the Vietnamese look at themselves, according to my interviewees. To get at this, at my hypothesis, I'm looking at archives, I'm looking at ethnographic stories of migrants, and you can see some of the literature there that has come out over the last probably 20 years or so. I'm looking specifically at serial migration and how forced migration, which hasn't been in the serial migration literature as much, how forced migration is a form of serial migration, especially when we look at this double forced migration, and in some cases triple, as some people moved from Vietnam, across the border into China, and then from China into Hong Kong, and then from Hong Kong into the UK. And finally, I'm exploring people in places, in these places that are occupied by Chinese background Vietnamese. And what I'm looking at there is looking at the frames, as Goffman says, everyday life, snapshots of everyday life. What is the identity like of a Chinese background Vietnamese in London at this time? My methodology is, in particular, is focused on, over the last decade, really participant observation, attending conferences, hanging out with people, spending time in Vietnamese venues, particularly centers, restaurants, homes, doing archival work, semi-structured interviews, and then informal conversations. It's been a wonderful experience of being associated with Vietnamese here in this city. Looking at forced migration, I want to just lay out a brief definition by Wood. She states that current patterns and trends in forced migration are increasingly a result of ethnic conflict, inequitable access to natural resources, declining living conditions, and then chronic and pervasive human rights abuses. And at the end of this talk, what I'd like to do is come back and revisit maybe three pieces of literature that I would challenge you to look at if you're interested in the subject, and think about this whole idea of the difference between economic migration and forced migration in terms of fear of life. And are those things really that separated? And that's a real question that I want to challenge us with. Now, looking at the field sites, we have Hong Kong, and if you can read that, between 75 and 2000, over 200,000 Vietnamese and Chinese background Vietnamese passed through Hong Kong. As I said, the refugee camps were initially open and then closed. Hong Kong did not sign the international agreements on country of first asylum, and so they felt quite I wouldn't say comfortable, but they felt quite free to repatriate 69,000 Vietnamese. It was an internationally controversial decision at that time. 1,429 were officially settled in Hong Kong. Most of those were intermarriages with Hong Kong Chinese. 35,000 were moved on to the United Kingdom under Thatcher's term of office here in the UK. The balance were settled primarily in the United States, France, Canada, and Australia. And I have here a photo of a reception center that is now derelict, but still exists there. In Hong Kong, the ethnic Chinese refugees were crowded in these warehouses. In 1979, I dropped out of college after 2 months, and I went back to Asia, to Southeast Asia, and I worked, or East Asia, and went to the refugee camps in Hong Kong and worked there for several months. Having a capacity in Vietnamese at the time, I was really not interested in studying. I wanted to do something about this refugee issue that was so pressing in 1979. And this is one of the camps that I was working in. And Kai Tak. Field sites in London, on the other hand, the current population estimates of Vietnamese in the UK are 50 to 100,000. One of the difficulties is the census in the UK does not measure those who were born here, only those who were born abroad. And so it's very difficult to determine the numbers. 30,000 originally arrived from Hong Kong into the UK beginning in 79. They were scattered across Britain and as part of a failed dispersal policy. I want to speak to that for just a moment. Dispersal is a policy that exists all across Europe. One of the issues that happened with Vietnamese in Britain is the fact that some people were scattered into small towns and villages in Scotland or Wales and northern England. And I remember one of my interviewees said, "Stephen, can you imagine? We could buy packets of rice in 250-gram bags. How can a Vietnamese buy enough 250-gram bags to feed a family?" And so there were some humorous stories that were coming out of that dispersal, but the common theme was loneliness. We don't have a community, and we are a community-based culture. And how can we survive when we don't have the community around us? And so in a few moments, I'll show you a graphic on that. 85% of that 30,000 were Chinese background Vietnamese, most of them from North Vietnam. Only about 15% are Southerners here in the UK. The majority settled in London following secondary migration after 1980, and as I said, 40 years of presence. So Vietnamese communities are scattered across London, as you can see, just north and south of the river, primarily in Hackney, and then Thamesmead is a major area, but you can see they're scattered in many different places across London. And the graphic is promised on dispersal. This is a map of secondary migration of Vietnamese into London. So some people lasted 2 months in Leeds, for instance. Some people lasted a year, but many people moved on into London from places across. The primary places of people coming were Glasgow, Newcastle, Liverpool, and Birmingham. This is what I call a failed policy of dispersal. I have some suggestions, but you'll have to wait for the book. No, I'm kidding. I'm just teasing. I have some thoughts about dispersal, but that's one of the things I'd like to ask you, maybe at the end, is to have your ideas and your thoughts about what is the answer to settlement when you have lots of people coming. Is it gathering more than just two or three families in a city? Maybe putting 80 people in a city? Is it? What are the answers? And so these are some photos of London that looking across the river to the north into the city, then looking down toward the south, London Bridge there, in Hackney, and areas just north of where we are here, and then looking across down into Thamesmead, Deptford, that area. In terms of affiliations, I've been working with a number of different community centers, and I have to thank each of them, the VLC, which is now Center 151, the An Viet Community Center in Hackney. Councillor Khan Thanh Vu has been really, in many ways, a father for me over the last 15 or 20 years. Locally, you see in the mile, I think some people are calling it now. I've discovered that just recently. Up in Hackney along Kingsland Road, you have the Pho Mile, and I found it interesting that the Huong Quay is there right next to the Bro X. And that's London, isn't it? It's this mix of multi-ethnic and then boots off to the right. That's a tremendous mix of different cultures. And I love that about London. Diaspora in question through migrant mobilities. I think this whole idea of diaspora is one that we need to problematize, this concept, the definitions, the idea of diaspora. I won't go into that here, but I wanted to give you a preliminary interview, a young 1.5 generation or someone who was born in Vietnam but then came as a young person to the U.S. or to the U.K. He says, when my parents were in China, they couldn't settle because the Chinese had seen them as Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese saw them as Chinese. So unwanted by both sides, they had no choice but to find other solutions of getting a good life. And in this particular case, the family crossed the river into China, were settled by the Chinese for a number of about 2 years in China, in farmland, bad farmland. And the wife said to the husband, "I'm not raising my two boys as poor farmers in China. We have to get to Hong Kong." And so he was able to work his way by sailing a boat. If you were willing to sail and had the skills to sail, then they would allow you to bring your family free of charge, and you didn't have to pay the thousands of pounds in gold that others paid. They got their way to Hong Kong, and after 2 years in Hong Kong, they came to the UK. But this statement raises that whole Foucauldian question. Who has the power to decide? In this case, membership in the diaspora. Who gets to say, you're Chinese, you're Vietnamese, or I'm Chinese, I'm Vietnamese, I'm British, or in the case of many of my informants, I'm a Londoner. Participants are both products of and participants in this process of diaspora making. How does it play out vis-a-vis forced migrations? Identity and belonging in flux. A Chinese background Vietnamese respondent working daily with ethnic minorities. She's actually working in mental health. She struggles with questions of identity, and she explained her background. Identity is always changing, she says. When I arrived in Britain from Hong Kong, because of my experience, I hated the Vietnamese. So I told people I was from Hong Kong. I only lived there for 8 months. But I didn't want to associate with Vietnamese. Then, 5 years later, she found herself telling people that I was born in Vietnam as a Chinese Vietnamese. And it got easier, she said. And this whole idea of identity changing, I think this is what we need to look at when we are examining this whole notion of identity. And as one scholar said, Akhtar, he says that it's as if, just as an adolescent has to do the battles to find out who they are, refugees coming into a new place also have to go through those same battles of finding out who they are, bumping up against various identities in order to find out, who am I then, in relationship with these others. Another respondent was asked whether she and her parents considered themselves refugees. She said, you know, we never called ourselves refugees. We see ourselves as immigrants. And again, who gets to decide who's a refugee and who's an immigrant? These terms are loaded. So then I said, economic migrant or refugee from her? And she said, we're economic migrants, I have to admit. But we had to leave because my father could not find work or go to university, even with his qualifications, because of our Chinese surname. When I started school, it was difficult to register. And this is a family who left in 1989. So the persecution against Chinese started in 1979. The family decided they would stay on. They were not going to leave with everyone else. And by 1989, found it untenable. There's no way he could provide for his family. Economic refugee or economic migrant or refugee? These are the questions. Both, perhaps. When asked how they perceive themselves, Chinese background Vietnamese respondents, they struggled. One respondent said, in New Cross, this is a young man who now has his degree in a PhD in informatics. In New Cross, I grew up in a highly multicultural environment. When I was young, I didn't grow up thinking of myself different to other people. Today, when people ask, where are you from? To keep it short, I tell them, I'm British. Of course, if they want to dive into some layers, I love that, I could explain to them, ethnically, I'm Chinese. I would say to them, my parents are Vietnamese Chinese. I would have to explain a bit more to them. As you can see, my background is not straightforward. There are small racist discriminations outside of London. He had done a course in a town outside of London and experienced some racism. But that's not the entire story of my experience, not all negative. My experience has been that I feel better socializing in London, being a Londoner. And this is a question that I'm asking my respondents. Do you consider yourself British, Chinese, Vietnamese, Chinese background Vietnamese, or Londoner? And many of the 1.5 generation are saying, British, maybe. Yeah, I've got a passport. But to be honest, I feel comfortable in London. I don't feel comfortable outside of London. And these are important questions I think we need to ask. You always feel that you're proud and that you're now out in society and you're contributing to the society, you are making a change, and this is what I want to do with my life. So I'd like to do this is the interactive bit. If you don't mind, turn to your neighbor or someone around, even if you don't know them, sort of put yourself out there. And I'd like for you to answer two questions. One is there a Londoner identity? Some of you have lived here for months, some of you have lived here all your life. But I'd like to ask you, what is your thought on that? Is there a Londoner identity? So I'm going to give you 1 or 2 minutes. Please, jump in. Okay, let's come back together. So what do you think? Is there a London identity? What are your thoughts? Anyone? Any nodded heads? Yes? No?
I think there's a gentleman here who should explain. He's got a very good idea.
Okay, yeah.
Actually, I don't know if I'm the right one because I don't come from London.
That's
but
all right.
As an outsider who stayed here like 6 months, I got the feeling that people would say that there's a London identity because you start to say London identity when you got the feeling it's different than when you say I have a British identity because this place is very special. It sees itself multi-ethnic, as we saw Hung Kui next to Woods. So I think because it's so special, it needs a distinct label, something like this.
Yeah, good.
I also asked John if he thought he was a Londoner and if it could be a longer name, he said yes, which is interesting.
It is interesting. It is interesting. And I think we have to ask the question, who are we talking about? Are we talking about the people in the street who consider themselves Londoners? Or are we talking about the powers that be who identify people as Londoners? And I think we need to make that distinction. So yes, I think the multi-ethnicity is a special aspect of this that allows people, perhaps, to feel at home, even if they don't feel at home outside. Anyone else, please?
So I'm a Londoner, so I've been born in, I'm a born and bred Londoner. And so last year I went to Leeds to do a master's, and people kept asking me, like, where am I from? And I found it much easier to say that I'm from London, because, like, London, you associate with multiculturalism.
Yeah.
And even though they were trying to dig at me, so where are you really from? So I found it much, if I said I was from London, they'd be like, oh, okay, I get you, like, you're not, like, British, but you're a Londoner.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, like, I'm not white British, but I'm multi-ethnic.
Right.
So
you feel like people outside of London understand London as this place of multiculture.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, with a multicultural identity in a sense, yeah, as a space. It's fascinating. Anyone else? Yes, please.
I've actually lived in Blackpool,
okay,
which is a very British part of England, and then I moved down to London 4 or 5 years ago, and it's really different, because when I was up in the north, you really feel that it's really British. You go outside, it's only Brits there. Maybe there's a Chinese restaurant, you might see Chinese person, Indian restaurant, Indian person, but you come down to London and you do really feel that it's not Britain anymore.
Yeah.
It's like a different city. And also, I'm Vietnamese from the Czech Republic, and so people in the Czech Republic, when they ask me, so where do you live in Britain? I tell them, I'm from London. Well, I live in London, and the one thing they always ask me, yes, but London is not really England, is it? So I do tell them, yeah, it's very multicultural.
That's an important distinction, absolutely. And so this whole idea of even people outside of the UK recognizing London as something different, something special. So this is something I'd like to challenge you guys to explore in your thinking and in your discussions. Are we seeing, in a sense, a rise of the city-state? A reconfiguring of the city-state where the multicultural city, such as London or New York, becomes, in a sense, its own identity separate from the nation and the national identity. And I think this is a question in our time that we need to be asking. As we can see from the Brexit vote, the urban centers were quite different to the outside. Good, good. Thank you for that. Thank you for you guys' participation. So what I'd like to do as we begin to wind up is I wanted to give this quote, and I was going to allow you to hear this interviewee, but I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead. It's very weird, she said. I always say I'm from Vietnam, but they say, you don't sound Vietnamese. She has a very posh English accent.
Oops. Interviewing in September 2016.
Sorry about that.
In London, England.
So looks like we've got sound. We didn't have sound. So she says, I'm conflicted at times. Sometimes people here think I'm Hong Kong because of the way I speak and because my surname is a very typical Cantonese surname. Thank you. And I feel very Vietnamese, but not quite Vietnamese. But I don't feel completely British either. So I feel quite weird. When I go to Vietnam, they can tell I'm not from Vietnam. So. And then she says, we as a family are more Vietnamese than a lot of Chinese. We don't really speak Chinese much, and we have no connections whatsoever to China. And so we find that identity is wrapped up in accents, surnames, spaces lived, birthplaces. All of these things are a part of our identity. And so as we conclude our time, this particular segment, this project is really focused on migration and mobility, as we said. It's focused on identity and subjectivity. Anthropological notions of place and their influence on mobilities. And as I consider my respondent mentioned earlier, I can describe this work as an attempt to examine the intertwining relationships between the refugee, her fellow refugees from diverse backgrounds and ideologies, the institutions that exacted power over her subjectivity, and finally the places through which she passed and in which she now lives. Patricia Owens, discussing Agamben and Arendt, asserted that refugees are a clue to a new political model of international relations. I hope that this project will shed further light as anthropologists, sociologists, and others grapple with blurring boundaries, increasingly complex human institutions, greater linkages through globalization, while at the same time wrestling with the closing of borders and isolationism of some nations, regions, and communities. This is an historical moment in our human history, as we see here in Europe, especially, and across the Atlantic and the United States, a closing down of borders rather than an opening of borders. Globalization taking an interesting turn as we look at negotiations between nations. And then as a question for discussion, with the current emphasis on sanctuary cities and the place of undocumented non-citizens who nevertheless participate in the city as citizens, focus on participation. I offer the following for discussions of current refugee settlement practice as experienced more recently by the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, Bangladeshis, all hitting the water in Southeast Asia, the North African movement across the Mediterranean, Afghans, Syrians, Iraqi peoples, thinking about these migrations, thinking about these mobilities of these peoples, consider the need to rethink notions of citizenship in light of Monica Bersagni's postulation of a normative vision of urban citizenship in which a person would become a citizen not by explicit consent by fellow citizens, a la Foucault, but merely by presence and residence in a place. Mark Purcell says urban politics of the inhabitant, as he talks about it, through his critique of Lefebvre's Right to the City, this whole idea of looking at the urban world, not the nation, but looking at the urban center. And then Engen, Isin's notion that with postmodernization and globalization, citizenship is less concerned with legal rules and more on norms, practices, meanings, and identities. And I'll leave it there, and perhaps we can go into some discussion at this point. But thank you very much for your attention and for your participation.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much indeed. Let's give you a chance to get seated and take up your pen and pad. As the chair of the seminar, I have the prerogative and the pleasure of asking the first question while you all get to think of what questions you might like to ask our speaker. And I suppose I have a couple of interlinked reactions immediately upon listening to the talk, which reflect both on the qualities of the experience of being in London and how that links to this very interesting question of dispersal, the fact that it seemed that many people couldn't thrive in other contexts. You know, 2 months in Leeds apparently was enough. I mean, we have the person over there who managed a whole master's course, but others just 2 months, whereas somehow the call of London exists. And the way that you'd framed that was as if it was to do with the critical mass of similar people that existed in each space, which may of course be the reason, but I wonder if there's something distinctive about the appeal of living in a city like London, and I'm wondering what might be distinctive about the London setting, and indeed about the British context, that particularly inflects the experiences of this population as opposed to other Vietnamese diaspora populations. So I had a couple of thoughts. The first thing that struck me was that the people who contributed to the participatory discussion, who were all people of colour, were emphasising multiculturalism as the characteristic aspect of being a Londoner. I myself, when I was thinking about the question, wouldn't have signalled that as being a central feature, even though I do acknowledge that London is multicultural. So I grew up in the suburbs of London and never really considered myself a Londoner, because just living in the suburbs, I didn't know how to navigate all the tube lines and so forth. But now I'm working in the LSE and I'm living a bit more centrally in Zone 2, I start to feel maybe I do have some kind of claims to being a Londoner. So for me, it's much more about navigation of space rather than the multicultural aspect. And that shouldn't necessarily surprise us, because people with different positionalities are likely to latch onto different aspects of an urban experience. So I wondered, Is the Londoner identity and the appeal of the Londoner identity for your informants simply about multiculturalism, about it being a place that's accommodating of cultural difference, of not being subject to the forms of racism that they might be experiencing outside of the city? Or is it that precisely because of the very particular multiculturalism that exists in London, the fact that you have large Hong Kong populations, that you have Chinese populations, that you have Vietnamese populations, that you have others, that it's a space in which the various strands of their composite identities can be experienced and latched onto and held together, sometimes in tension with each other, in other ways coinciding, so that these different layers of identity that you're describing are also reflected in the kinds of experiences that people have as they move through the city? And might that make London a particularly welcoming place in the way that other multicultural cities that didn't have that particular combination of diasporas might not? Mm-hmm. So that was one reflection that I had. And then I was also reflecting on the trajectories of people's identifications. Your informant who began saying she was from Hong Kong, but then gradually moved on to identify as someone who was born in Vietnamese or a Chinese Vietnamese person. And I wondered what accounts for that trajectory, and in particular, how does the imperial relationship that Britain had towards Hong Kong, how do more general social attitudes that British people have towards Chinese and Hong Kong diaspora populations come to affect the way that these displaced Vietnamese populations come to identify? And is the process similar or different to the kinds of identifications that people might have, say, in the US, where there's a whole category of Asian American that has its own story but is quite different from that of the British Chinese?
Wonderful. Yeah, I'll let me address the dispersal question first, and in particular the multicultural question. I think it's a huge point that you're raising, that it isn't simply multiculturalism, absolutely. And I think the multiculturalism aspect, at least from these informants, is the fact that the multiculturalism of Britain allows for a diasporic population to thrive. It's they're able to thrive without persecution in many cases, with opportunities that London offers to, in some ways, become hidden in this city without any problems. And so I think you're exactly right. There are other places that are multicultural but may not have the size of the diasporas that London has. And I think that is unique. It is a space for individual populations, individual diasporas, to be able to find a place of safety and refuge, in a sense, that they wouldn't find outside. So in some ways, it is the larger numbers, and it is the fact, as I said, that the multiculturalism of London allows for diasporas to, in a sense, thrive. But that's a really good point, and I think that needs to be brought out further, that it's not a simple definition of multiculturalism, therefore these people feel at home. They feel at home because they're in their own, in a sense, in when one is either with one's own cultural group, I feel at home, or, as in the case of one of my informants, her friends are from all over the place, and she feels at home because she's not only with her own culture group. And so it allows for these different nuances of identity, which I think is important. In terms of the imperial relationship, Britain and Hong Kong, I think that's probably exactly what's going on, is people have realized that Hong Kong Britain has had a fond relationship with Hong Kong for these 100 years of colonialism, 99 years of colonialism. And so it becomes a simple definition to say, I'm from Hong Kong. And people say, oh, okay. They know that. It's familiar. But I think it is different to the Asian American experience. The Asian American experience, in a sense, there's a lot of critique now, in a sense, on the hyphenation of Asian American. And I think the reason for that, in some cases, at least from my research for a Master of Arts in Southeast Asian Studies, is because there are Asians who have come to America as students or who have come as immigrants more recently, who aren't part of that Asian American generational experience. And so therefore we need to have nuances of this idea of Asian American. What do we mean by that? And I think that's a very different sort of trajectory to the Vietnamese coming here and landing in London. And so Hong Kong then becomes in some ways a friendly identity in the British context. And I think that's how many of the informants would describe it or have described it. I don't know if that helps or answers the question, but those are my thoughts there. And I think that is something that needs to be brought out as we look at these different identities. That colonial relationship of Britain to Hong Kong has been a very positive one over the years. Probably the interesting thing that struck me in terms of the interviews was the fact that there was an intolerance on the part of Hong Kong that is very un-British. Mm. And I think that needs to be unpacked. How is it that Hong Kong didn't sign an agreement towards settlement of first country of asylum, and yet Britain did? And so that's a problematic that needs to be looked at. So thank you for that.
Great, thank you. So it's now open to the floor for questions. We have a roving mic, so please wait for the microphone to come so that you can be amplified. We are recording the session, so if there are any of you who would rather that your question were not recorded, then please do just let us know. So we have a question over here.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
My name is Gul. I'm studying at SOAS. I wanted to ask about, I know diaspora was originally used to describe the Jewish community, and it signified a common religious identity and a common community. Do you think the Chinese Vietnamese community shares a common diasporic consciousness?
Mm.
And the second question is, we talked about London being a magnet. I know in Little Saigon in California, when the first wave of migrations came over, there were very highly skilled and highly educated people, which created these networks where later generations could come who weren't so highly educated and skilled. They can plug into these networks. Do you think there was something existing in London, maybe with the Chinese community who came a lot earlier, and that was maybe a pull for the Chinese Vietnamese who came in the 70s, 80s?
Great questions. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Kung. Thank you for your email as well. Diasporic consciousness. I like that terminology. I like the way you put that. I like that. What I would say probably with the Vietnamese, as you rightly pointed out, the aspect of the Jewish diaspora, which is widely considered the first understanding of diaspora, had a lot to do with the forced migration. And that's what I'll bring out in this work is as we define diaspora, which is a very slippery term. This idea of a diasporic consciousness, I think the Chinese background Vietnamese, it's a bit problematic because, as you can hear from the interviews, people have a different understanding of what that means. What does diaspora mean? And there are interviewees who are from the 1.5 generation who don't consider themselves, or at least in practice, do not associate or relate widely to the Vietnamese or Chinese background Vietnamese community. They have friends who are from all over the place and they're Londoners. And so I think we have to be careful about layering or laying onto a population this notion of diaspora as if they're all one consciousness. So I think that's a caution that I would say. In terms of are they a diaspora, I think it, depending on your definition, I think they can be considered a part of the Vietnamese diaspora, but we have to make sure that we problematize this notion of Vietnamese diaspora and in a sense, parse it out into its parts, into its different populations. The Asian American, Vietnamese American understanding and experience is radically different to that of Chinese background Vietnamese in London, and that gets to your second question, were there existing networks in London? For those who spoke Cantonese, many of them did integrate into the Cantonese networks here in London. Those who didn't speak Cantonese struggled. Also, it has to be pointed out by interviewees and the literature that many of the Vietnamese who came to London, came to Britain, were not from the educated parts of Vietnam. They were many of them were farmers and fishermen from Hanoi and outside of Hanoi. The province is on the border with China, and also many, many from Haiphong. And so you had uneducated people who struggled when they arrived, whereas the South Vietnamese who came here and to the United States had some sort of, if not English ability, they at least had lived in a democratic system that allowed them to integrate into a more democratic system in the ways that obviously made it easier for them to navigate. So in terms of networks, what I'm finding with my informants is the fact that some of them had family who were here, and they helped. The community centers that were set up in 1978-79 were tremendously beneficial to many Vietnamese. One of my informants said her family came with a boat that the whole boat was accepted into Hong Kong. They sat off the coast, and they were accepted into Hong Kong as the lawyers and the government negotiated, and the whole boat was brought to London or to Britain as a community. And I think this gets back to one of the aspects of dispersal, is that the need to settle people within as communities, not as individuals. And I think this is an important point. And you raise that with this idea of existing networks in London. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I'm finding. Thank you. Boom.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Anthony. I'm a first year anthropologist student at the OSC. My question is about more political issues. Mm-hmm. Was the British government somehow forced to airlift those migrants from Hong Kong before the handover of the colony to China?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. And tell me your name.
Anthony,
yes, right. Anthony, that's a really good question. And in the literature, as well as through my interviewees and my informants, what we're finding is that there was pressure on the part of the Chinese government to sort out this, as they called it, the Vietnamese problem. And so the Thatcher government initially was not interested in taking Vietnamese into the UK. Most of the immigrants prior to the Vietnamese coming, with the exception perhaps in World War II of the Polish soldiers that were allowed in during World War II, there are a few examples of others, but most of them were Commonwealth peoples that came to Britain prior to 75, 78, 79. And so, in a sense, Thatcher was not interested in bringing this population over. Essentially, was she forced? Was the British government forced? The U.S. was accepting Vietnamese by the thousands, as was France. And there was, in a sense, pressure, from my understanding of the literature, for Thatcher to join the anti-communist movement of the West and to register that joining by inviting Vietnamese to come here. So yes, in a sense, there was international pressure for Britain to accept these peoples. As we get closer to 1997, the pressure began to be more heavily from the Chinese government. And many interviewees came in 1979 and 1980 in the early willingness of Thatcher to bring Vietnamese, and she had a certain number, I think it was 20,000, and then there were two subsequent programs where they brought Vietnamese on. But to be honest, what happened towards the end of the 80s and into the 90s was, I suppose into the 90s, was a forced repatriation back to Vietnam. As we said, 69,000 people repatriated, some of them voluntarily, many of them not. And sadly, there was a riot in several of the camps that because people were afraid to go back. And so there was a great backlash within both the Vietnamese, Chinese background and Vietnamese communities in the refugee camps, but also internationally against this repatriation. So yeah, there was a lot of pressure from lots of sides. And huge negotiations with the Vietnamese government to try and guarantee safety of those who were repatriated. So it was a huge effort on the part of the Chinese government, the British government in Hong Kong, and the Chinese government. So I hope that answers your question, but good point. And that's a huge point to study, I think, on policy, because Thatcher did a turnaround in the late 70s. Yeah. Okay.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for your talk. I'm Ha. I'm studying psychology and linguistics at UCL. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Vietnamese, but living here for a few years. And I just wanted to ask, I know your work is mainly based in, your field sites are Hong Kong and London, but how are the Vietnamese immigrants or refugees seen in Vietnam? And do they identify with these people, as in Vietnamese people identify with these people? And what do you make of the umbrella term Viet Kieu, which somewhat connotates, you know, a choice to leave rather than being forced to leave through forced migration, as you said?
Excellent question. Thank you, Ha. I'll start with Viet Kieu, this term that was used for Vietnamese who left Vietnam. And that term is usually used primarily for the American Vietnamese community rather than others. There are people who consider themselves Viet Kieu, but that term is mostly used with regard to the United States. And what I'm finding is that initially it was a very negative term. It basically meant traitor. It connotated a traitor, someone who left, someone who abandoned their country. They were stripped of citizenship. They settled in the West and in Australia. And this was the sort of operating procedure for a number of years. The turn came, it seems, in the 1990s, when all of a sudden, as Doi Mai in Vietnam, the restructuring and opening of Vietnam to the West and to more democratization of some sort, after Doi Mai, we began to see Vietnamese going back home on visits from even from America. And these were Viet Kieu and people from London going back on visits to visit family. And I think what happened was there was a turnaround within the Vietnamese government's perspective to all of a sudden see the Viet Kieu as a resource rather than as traitors. And so now you've got biochemical engineers and you've got doctors and you've got barristers and you've got people who are skilled, who have language, Vietnamese language ability, but are useless to the nation because they've been labeled as these traitors. And so the turnaround came after this restructuring in which Vietnamese were welcomed back. In fact, right now, you probably have heard that over the last probably 10 years, the Vietnamese government actually helps subsidize educated Vietnamese to come back during Tet. So they're going to be there this week to sort of, in a sense, showcase Vietnam as a place to come back and hang your shingle and practice medicine or practice, you know, your engineering or give back to the society. And as many of you know, the remittances coming from the West back to Vietnam are huge. And so so that's a great question. And we've seen a major shift in this term Viet Kieu from a very negative connotation to now one of a resource person who can be beneficial to Vietnam. Does that answer your question? Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, question at the front.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'd like to add something to the discussion. So you just, and this raised directly to Ha's question, is that you've got a part after the Vietnam War, you have the, say, Viet Kieu, that went to mostly the English-speaking countries. Mm-hmm. But then you have the second wave, which was during the Soviet brother states. And a lot of, for example, my parents, so a lot of the Vietnamese, after the war, the governments of the Soviet states, they helped each other out. So a lot of Vietnamese were sent to Russia,
exactly.
Ukraine, Czech Republic, East Germany. And after the German, after the Berlin Wall fell down,
mm-hmm.
a lot of Vietnamese, they kind of were forced to go home, but they didn't.
Yeah.
And a lot of them hit themselves, or they were labeled as refugees.
Yeah.
And a lot of Vietnamese, for example, in the Czech Republic or from East Europe, they run over to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's such a huge population of Vietnamese over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to sort of ask you, what do you think of these second wave of, maybe not Viet Kieu,
mm-hmm.
but Vietnamese overseas?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a term for that wave, and they're guest workers. Many people are considered guest workers, and as you rightly pointed out, during the Soviet era, there was a need to, in a sense, I don't want to use the word pay back, but there was a sense of a debt owed to the East Bloc nations. And so Vietnamese, many were sent to the Czech Republic, were sent to Czechoslovakia at that time, to Warsaw, to Poland, Krakow, Gdansk, other places, sent as engineers or as students, and many people were sent. In fact, we have Vietnamese here in London who were in positions, important positions, who actually came out as teenagers to Poland, for instance, and then have now migrated, say, to France or to the UK. And so this whole idea of serial migration is fascinating to me. So I think you're exactly right, and I think they are not necessarily considered Viet Kieu. These are guest workers who have overstayed their welcome, many of them in the East Bloc nations, and many who are legal. And they're a tremendous part of the society. So, yeah, I think I would make that distinction. And I think that distinction right there really is an important point that we've been saying, that we can't categorize the Vietnamese diaspora as a monolithic thing. It's a multifaceted thing. And these are people who came out just post-75. And went to these East Bloc nations. So yeah, I'm with you, but I would make a clear distinction between that and the idea of Viet Kieu.
Can I just quickly ask one more question? Mm-hmm. And then, so you also mentioned that the Vietnamese government, they have basically changed the way they look at Viet Kieu. It's not as traitors, but as a resource. So now the guest workers. In some way, you could put us in one basic basket that we are Viet Kieu's, Vietnamese overseas. Mm-hmm. And now, how do you see the Vietnamese government being able to actually touch into these resources to come back? Because we are basically a valuable resource that could, you know, benefit the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a piece that came out a number of years ago. I think it was 2010. I'm trying to remember the author now, but. There was a piece that came out, and it talked about the use of media and how do you reach into the Vietnamese diasporic overseas population. And so one of the ways that the Vietnamese government reaches out is VTV, local Vietnamese or international Vietnamese TV, transnational TV. But I think in a lot of ways, some of my informants are talking about the relationship of the Vietnamese embassy to the Vietnamese population in these various countries. And they're trying to court the Vietnamese in these places. There's a Tet celebration that will be happening at the Vietnamese embassy here. Probably 300 or 400 Vietnamese will show up. And so there are ways that the embassies are tasked with reaching out to the Vietnamese in the country in which they're based. I think another aspect of this is the whole idea of remittances. And it's a very sort of difficult terrain because does Vietnam tax people who are living abroad? Do they allow them to voluntarily send remittances back? Do they tax those remittances when they arrive in the country? These are all questions that the Vietnamese government is dealing with right now with regard to this whole overseas population. And I think you rightly pointed out it's probably better to think about all of this in terms of an overseas Vietnamese population than these loaded terms called Viet Kieu or diaspora or these others. And I think much of the literature coming out now, particularly with Eastern Europe, are calling the Vietnamese an overseas Vietnamese population. And so, yeah, there's a lot of literature on the Vietnamese in Eastern Europe now. Christina Schwenkel has written on post-socialist mobilities, and this is all about Vietnamese who have come back and forth between the East Bloc or the Eastern European nations and Vietnam. And then there's several Polish scholars that have also been writing. So, yeah, thank you for that. Excellent.
Hi, I'm looking at the title behind you. It says forced migration. But I'm wondering, so throughout your presentation, it didn't really come out in your interviews about the forced migration specifically. When I was sort of reading through the interview transcripts you got up, they just sounded like quite very common. So a lot of my London friends who are not white, they would say like quite similar things. I was wondering, is there a significance of the forced migration on identity that you found?
Yeah, and that's a really excellent question. Thank you for that. Yeah.
So say in comparison to like non-forced migration, so people have just moved around a lot.
Right. Yeah, and this is, I think... what we're finding, when you look at the literature on serial migration, you also have some similar questions of identity. You know, who am I? What I'm trying to problematize is this whole idea of forced migration, particularly when we look at a double forced migration or multiple forced migrations. What I'm looking at is the impact it has on being unwanted. That's really the factor that I'm looking at, that distinguishes someone who decides, I can find a better job, or my kids can have a better life if I move somewhere else. These are people who've been through persecution for being who they are, either their Chinese surname or the fact that they had a grandfather. One of my interviewees said, my family are Chinese background. In the latter 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, one of my relatives came from China. And, you know, so this is what we're talking about. But a name, a surname, gets carried from generation to generation. And so I think I would probably hinge it on this idea of being unwanted, that these are people who may not, you know, in some ways, and this is where I'm problematizing economic migration versus refugee status. We need to, those two things in some ways are interlinked. And people feel that, no, nobody was going to kill them, but they had no way to make a living. And the doors were closing on any possibility of making any kind of living, going to university, improving themselves, getting their children in school. All of these doors began to close, particularly in 1978, 1979. Does that help answer the question a little bit?
Really good.
Yeah,
answer.
Yeah. I think it is this idea of being unwanted, and that's coloring people's identity, saying, well, then maybe I'm not Vietnamese, if the Vietnamese government says I'm not Vietnamese. How do I deal with that? Yeah.
We have time for one or two more questions if anyone would like to make any more contributions. Yes.
I wanted to ask about intergenerational relationships. So the 1.5 generation between their parents and increasingly now between their children. And how does these identities get transcended through these relationships? And I have to apologize for using another term that I picked up from somewhere else, linguistic gatekeeping, as the idea that language is this idea where it's linked to your identity. How does this come through with your interviewees, whether their parents chose to speak, say, Vietnamese, Chinese, Hakka, Cantonese?
Sure.
And how does this affect their identity?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, as we were saying, it's not just accents, it's language. And one of my interviewees said, we spoke Vietnamese at home, but when we arrived in Hong Kong, my parents only spoke Chinese because they saw the future as being Chinese. Another interviewee said, my parents never really learned English very well because they were thinking, their bags are in a sense packed, they're thinking, if we go somewhere else, we're not going to be using English anyway, so why spend the time learning it? So they're always thinking about that next place. Are we going to have to move again, in other words? So this whole question of linguistics is problematic. What I found with a number of interviewees is that the 1.5 generation continued to speak language, either Chinese or Vietnamese or both. Their children are struggling. And so they send them back to Vietnam to relatives to say, you got to get this. And the kids are, you know, kicking and screaming as they go back to Vietnam, thinking this is a foreign land. It's a foreign place. I don't know Vietnamese very well. And community centers more and more are losing funding to be able to offer Vietnamese as a language to, say, in Saturday school or something like that. So this is a huge question right now as to who these people are going to be as they grow up generation on generation. Will they still be Vietnamese, or are they going to become British and fold into the community and they'll lose their relationships? One of my interviewees, a young professional, has two kids. At that time, I interviewed him probably 3 and 6. And he was saying that our regret is that we haven't spoken Vietnamese at home. We speak English all the time. And he was 1.5 generation. And he said, my kids are probably not going to see themselves as Vietnamese. Another interviewee said his kids are in their teenage years now, but he said about 5 years ago, he said, you know, Stephen, the difference is I have Vietnam there. I grew up there. My kids don't have that. And their mom is Eastern European. They're, you know, in a sense, European Asians. And their friends are in, you know, South London. So they don't have any kind of loyalty. They have no kind of understanding of their identity as as tied to the nation of Vietnam. And so I think language is huge. And as language disappears, often identity disappears. And so I think that's probably the point, the fulcrum. Yeah. I like that. Linguistic gatekeeping.
Great. So we have one final question.
I have just a question around your methodology. So from my experience of living in London, a lot of Hua people, they sort of are with the Chinese community. Then you mentioned that you're with the An Viet Foundation and you went to visit Nguyen Gue, which is Vietnamese. I'm wondering, how did you find these Chinese Vietnamese people?
Yeah.
Because, like you say, identity is changing, etc.
Exactly. That's a really good question. How did I find the Vietnamese that I'm interviewing? Yeah, I started out about 14 years ago, doing my Master of Philosophy at Goldsmiths, and I was looking at Vietnamese transnational connections. And in that case, I wasn't looking specifically for any aspect of the diaspora. I was just interviewing Vietnamese in general. And so when I began this project several years ago, what I began to do was go to my networks that I had had before, and I asked them, do you know any Chinese background Vietnamese who self-identify as Viet Quoc Hoa? And so that started me on the path. And then there's something we call in anthropology, sociology, called snowballing, where you meet someone and then you meet someone else. And so when I was doing some research this summer, and I met a young lady who was not Chinese background Vietnamese in one of the restaurants in Hanoi. They're from Hanoi, and she said, "Oh, I know two or three people. I'll contact them and give me your number, and I'll give it to them." And I've probably gotten 7 interviews out of that one contact. And these are Vietnamese, Chinese background Vietnamese. Some of them who consider themselves Europeans, Londoners. There are a whole range of people, but these are people that she knew through her connections. And so I think, you, in a sense, you find people by being in the community asking questions, and someone leads you to someone else who leads you to someone else.
So how did the An Viet Foundation come into this story? Because it's a Vietnamese
As a Vietnamese community center, the An Viet Foundation really, in a sense, gave me an understanding of one aspect of the Vietnamese community here. And a lot of people who come to the An Viet Foundation are from the South. And so that helped me to begin to think about this idea that the Vietnamese community is not monolithic, that it's not one community, because I could go there and see people from the South, and my accent tends to be more from the South and more from Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City. And then, to be honest, it took me probably 2 or 3 years to begin to get into the North America or the North Vietnamese community. Yeah, so it's a great question. Yeah.
Well, one of the great things about fantastic anthropological research is that it doesn't only unpack pre-established categories and question received wisdom, such as, you know, how clear-cut is a distinction between an economic migrant versus someone who's a refugee or a forced migrant, what might the stakes be in adopting either claim, and to really bring out the complexity that underlies social life. And it also shows how that complexity, despite being complex, is nevertheless structured in very particular ways that reflect the histories and situations of the people involved. And I think, Stephen, you've really managed to do both of those things wonderfully for us this evening. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to all of you for coming and for your contributions to the discussion, which was really fascinating. But please join me in giving a very, very warm round of applause to our speaker, Stephen Jones. I think that concludes the formal part of this evening's proceedings, but I'm sure if any of you would like to chat further or ask any informal questions to Stephen, you'd be very, very welcome to. From me and from all of us here at the Southeast Asia Centre at the LSE, thank you very much for coming along, and have a safe journey home.
Thank you very much.